From the Voice of America, this is Learning English Weekend. I'm Katie Weaver. It is Saturday, June 3rd, 2016. Welcome to the Learning English Podcast. Today on the show, we hear the second and final part of the short story Hearts and Crosses by American writer O. Henry. We also go to Florida as part of our year-long series on national parks. Ann Ball and I tell you about the watery wonder that is the Everglades. And we hear about a new play that explores the lives of American automobile workers during the 2008 economic crisis. But first, let's go to the movies. Christopher Jones Cruise reports on a new comedy that plays for laughs as well as understanding among Americans.
Iranian-American funny man Maz Jobrani has made a movie about an Iranian who moves to the United States and becomes a hero. The movie is called Jimmy Vestwood, American Hero. In the film, people from the Middle East are good. This is just the opposite of many Hollywood movies, where Middle Easterners are bad or evil.
We wanted to do a movie where the guy who saves the day in the end of the movie is of Middle Eastern descent. Because as you know, 9 times out of 10 when you see a Middle Easterner in an American movie, he's saying, "I will kill you in the name of Allah." You know, it's usually a terrorist or some bad guy.
Jobrani says the script for the movie was written over 10 years. But the movie was filmed in Los Angeles in 18 days. He says no major production companies would make the film, so he and his partners made it themselves.
What's your occupation?
We are not here to occupy you. We only come in peace.
Welcome to America.
Hollywood does not know that there's an audience for this type of film yet, but I know through my stand-up comedy that there is an audience that wants to see Middle Easterners in a positive light, in a fun light. Not just Middle Easterners, but also Americans who come to my shows who want to see a different side of Middle Easterners.
Jobrani believes Americans will understand and like some of the jokes in the movie.
I think that Americans are very smart, and I think that we underestimate a lot of Americans. There's a lot of Americans who are more internationally minded. They are curious about other parts of the world, and I know that because of my shows. When I do live shows, I look out in the audience, it's like 50% just white Americans, black Americans, Asian Americans, other Americans than Middle Easterners.
Now, the crowd behind me can be seen celebrating the recent crash of a U.S. drone.
I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
Well, I don't know about you folks, but I certainly pray he doesn't make it.
We go now from the screen to the stage. Jill Robbins reports about a new play in New York City.
Detroit, Michigan has been the center of America's automobile industry since the early 20th century. Detroit, the Motor City, as it is known, is home to the big three U.S. automakers, General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford. This year, U.S. automakers are expected to sell a record number of vehicles. And Michigan produces more cars and trucks than any other state. But it is hard to forget 2008. That year, the U.S. government rescued GM and Chrysler from failure. Ford also received help, a government line of credit. During that period, hundreds of thousands of workers lost their jobs as auto factories and their supply companies shrank or closed. Now, a new play in New York looks at four auto workers struggling in hard economic times. Skeleton Crew is the latest play by Detroit native Dominique Morisseau. It is her third play about her hometown. Skeleton Crew received a special honor at this year's Obie Awards. The Obies recognize plays performed at New York area theaters with fewer than 500 seats. The play takes place at a factory that makes car parts for the big three automakers. But times are difficult. The factory has dismissed a lot of workers. Those who remain are the skeleton crew, the fewest workers required to keep the factory operating. Morisseau spoke about the play earlier this year to radio station WNYC.
It's exploring a group of workers, a family of workers, who sort of have to all deal with the different impacts that this potential closing will have on them.
The story is all very personal for Morisseau, who was born and raised in Detroit. She said she wanted to learn more about the people that lived through some of the city's crises. So she went home to talk to people about what it felt like to be in Detroit in 2008, when the auto industry was on the edge of collapse. For the workers in Skeleton Crew, it was an earth-shaking moment. Ruben Santiago Hudson is the play's director. He says Morisseau is able to create her characters with empathy.
This play is really important in the sense that you come into the world of blue-collar life. So to go and see the integrity of these people, and also how they feed off each other. They're so all different, and they all need each other.
Nikia Mathis plays the part of Shanita in Skeleton Crew. At one point, Shanita is talking to co-worker Faye Davis, played by Linda Gravatt.
You got to make yourself irreplaceable. That's what I'm doing.
How you figure you irreplaceable? I've been from stamping doors to installing shops to them 7 years I spent sewing interiors. Ain't nobody in this plant more irreplaceable than Faye Davison.
But as Skeleton Crew goes on, all the workers learn just how replaceable they are. The supervisor could lose his house in the economic downturn. The worker might have to take a lower-paying job as she prepares to have her first baby. And shop leader Faye has been making cars her entire life, but now she lives in one. Linda Gravatt says Faye is both strong and defenseless.
And life has beaten her, and she hasn't quite figured out how to negotiate how life has beaten her or why it has beaten her. So she, you know, spends her money going to casinos, which many people do.
In a way, Skeleton Crew examines how the financial crisis in Detroit and in the country creates personal crises. Santiago Hudson says those crises feel and sound real.
Dominique hears the language of her life, of her community. And she not only hears it, she relays it just the way she heard it.
She's just trying to let you experience them, he says. I'm Jill Robbins.
We want to know what you want to hear on our show. Send an email with your ideas and comments to learningenglish@voanews.com. And don't forget to visit our website at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can also reach us on the VOA Learning English Facebook page.
Today, on our National Parks journey, we explore the Everglades in South Florida. When many people think of Florida, images of sandy coasts, theme parks, and rocket launches come to mind. But it is also home to a natural wilderness different from any other in the United States. Everglades National Park is the largest subtropical wilderness in the U.S. Several rare and endangered species live in the park. It is a huge place, covering more than 600,000 hectares of wetlands. It is also a popular park. More than 1 million visitors pass through the official entrances every year. But others enter the park on water and go uncounted.
In 1947, President Harry Truman spoke at the official opening of Everglades National Park. He said the goal of creating the park was to protect forever a wild area that could never be replaced. The Everglades is considered one of the biological wonders of the world. It is a place where plants and animals from the Caribbean Sea share an ecosystem with native North American species. 9 different environments exist within the Everglades. They include mangrove and cypress swamps, estuaries, and coastal marshes.
In the 1940s, reporter and environmentalist Marjorie Stoneman Douglas wrote a book called The Everglades, River of Grass. She described the area as the liquid heart of Florida. Everglades National Park was created to protect an ecosystem from damage. The Everglades is home to about 30 species that federal officials say are threatened or endangered. They include the Florida panther, the American crocodile, and the West Indian manatee. More than 350 bird species and 300 species of fresh and saltwater fish live within the park. The Everglades is also home to 40 species of mammals and 50 reptile species.
Visitors to the Everglades will see many exotic plants. They include what is said to be the largest growth of mangrove trees in the Western world. Gumbo limbo trees, known for their peeling red skin. Strangler figs and royal palms are also among the area's plant life. The country's largest living mahogany tree also lives in the Everglades. Sawgrass grows in some areas of the park. Be careful. Sawgrass is very sharp, with teeth just like a saw. It can grow up to 4 meters tall. With about 1.5 meters of rainfall each year, plants and trees never stop growing in the Everglades. The dry winter season is the favorite of most visitors, when insects like mosquitoes are less of a problem. The rainy season lasts from June to November.
There are many ways to explore the Everglades. Visitors can see alligators while hiking the Anhinga Trail. The park is one of the only places in the world where freshwater alligators and saltwater crocodiles live in the same area. Visitors using canoes are likely to observe large groups of wading birds, like the wood stork or the great blue heron. Bright pink flamingos also thrive in the Everglades. Some visitors might enjoy riding bicycles through Shark Valley. Others might want to take it more slowly. The boardwalk walking trail goes right over the slow-moving water. Visitors can take a close look at insects and other wildlife. The park also offers tram rides for guided tours.
The National Park Service says that early colonial settlers and land developers believed the Everglades had little value. The settlers had plans to remove water from the area. In the 1880s, developers began digging canals to reduce water levels. At the time, they did not understand the complexity of the Everglades ecosystem. As a result, they were not prepared for all the work. They caused environmental problems. Larger efforts to drain the wetlands continued between 1905 and 1910. Farms were built on large pieces of land. More people began to move to the Everglades. More changes came mid-century. The federal government built roads, canals, and water control systems throughout South Florida. The project was aimed at providing water and flood protection for people and farms. Workers built a huge system of waterways and pumping stations to control the overflow of Lake Okeechobee north of the Everglades.
In more recent years, environmental experts learned about the damage to the Everglades. Some experts say the balance of nature in the area has been destroyed. Today, some of South Florida's early wetland areas no longer exist. Populations of wading birds have been reduced by 90%. Whole populations of animals are in danger of disappearing. In 2000, Congress approved a plan to restore and improve the Everglades. Federal, state, and other organizations are partners in the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. The future is not clear for the wild and beautiful Everglades, but efforts are underway to protect this biological treasure. The hope is that people may continue to visit the extraordinary Everglades National Park long into the future. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Ann Ball.
Finally, we return to the O. Henry story, Hearts and Crosses. It was a sad ending to part one last week. Texas cowboy Webb Yeager had left his wife Santa after many years of marriage. He had felt like an unequal partner in their relationship and shared business. Will the couple be rejoined? Let's find out.
Hearts and Crosses. One day, a man named Bartholomew, not an important man, stopped at the Nopalito Ranch House. It was noon, and he was hungry. He sat down at the dinner table. While he was eating, he talked. "Mrs. Yeager," he said, "I saw a man on the Seco Ranch with your name, Webb Yeager. He was foreman there. He was a tall, yellow-haired man. Not a talker. Someone of your family?"
"A husband," said Santa.
"That is fine for the Seco Ranch. Mr. Yeager is the best foreman in the West."
Everything at the Nopalito Ranch had been going well. For several years, they'd been working at the Nopalito with a different kind of cattle. These cattle had been brought from England, and they were better than the usual Texas cattle. They had been successful at the Nopalito Ranch, and men on the other ranches were interested in them. As a result, one day a cowboy arrived at the Nopalito Ranch and gave the queen this letter.
"Mrs. Yeager, the Nopalito Ranch. I've been told by the owners of the Seco Ranch to buy 100 of your English cattle. If you can sell these to the Seco, send them to us in care of the man who brings this letter. We will then send you the money. Webb Yeager, foreman, Seco Ranch."
Business is business to a queen as it is to others. That night, the 100 cattle were moved near the ranch house, ready for an early start the next morning. When the night came and the house was quiet, did Santa Yeager cry alone? Did she hold that letter near to her heart? Did she speak the name that she had been too proud to speak for many weeks? Or did she place the letter with other business letters in her office? Ask if you will, but there is no answer. What a queen does is something we cannot always know. But this you shall be told. In the middle of the night, Santa went quietly out of the ranch house. She was dressed in something dark. She stopped for a moment under a tree. There was moonlight, and a bird was singing. There was a smell of flowers. Santa turned her face toward the southeast and threw three kisses in that direction. But there was no one to see her. Then she hurried quietly to a small building. What she did there, we can only guess. But there was the red light of a fire and noise as if Cupid might be making his arrows. Later, she came out with some strange iron tool in one hand. In the other hand, she carried something that held a small fire. She hurried in the moonlight to the place where the English cattle had been gathered. Most of the English cattle were a dark red, but among those 100, there was one as white as milk. And now Santa caught that white animal as cowboys catch cattle. And she tried once and failed. Then she tried again, and the animal fell heavily. Santa ran to it, but the animal jumped up. Again she tried, and this time she was successful. The animal fell to earth again. Before it could rise, Santa had tied its feet together. Then she ran to the fire she had carried here. From it, she took that strange iron tool. It was white hot. There was a loud cry from the animal as the white hot iron burned its skin. But no one seemed to hear. All the ranch were quiet. And in the deep night quiet, Santa ran back to the ranch house and there fell onto a bed. She let the tears from her eyes as if queens had hearts like the hearts of ranchmen's wives, and as if a queen's husband might become a king if he would ride back again. In the morning, the young man who had brought the letter started toward the Saco Ranch. He had cowboys with him to help him with the English cattle. It was 90 miles, 6 days' journey. The animals arrived at Saco Ranch one evening as the daylight was ending. They were received and counted by the foreman of the ranch. The next morning at 8, a horseman came riding to the Nopalito Ranch House. He got down painfully from the horse and walked to the house. His horse took a great breath and let his head hang and closed his eyes. Bud did not feel sorry for Belshazzar, the horse. Today, he lives happily at Nopalito, where he is given the best care and the best food. No other horse there has ever carried a man for such a ride. The horseman entered the house. Two arms fell around his neck, and someone cried out in the voice of a woman and queen together,
"Webb! Oh, Webb!"
"I was wrong," said Webb Yeager. "I was a..." And he named a small animal with a bad smell, an animal no one likes.
"Quiet," said Santa. "Did you see it?"
"I saw it," said Webb. "What were they speaking of? Perhaps you can guess if you have read the story carefully." "Be the cattle queen," said Webb. "Forget what I did if you can. I was wrong as..."
"Quiet,"
said Santa again, putting her fingers upon his mouth.
"There's no queen here. Do you know who I am? I am Santa Yeager, first lady of the bedroom." "Come here."
She led him into a room. There stood a low baby's bed. And in the bed was a baby, a beautiful laughing baby, talking in words that no one could understand.
"There is no queen on this ranch," said Santa again. "Look at the king. He has eyes like yours, Webb. Get down on your knees and look at the king."
There was a sound of steps outside, and Bud Turner was there at the door. He was asking the same question he had asked almost a year ago. "Good morning. Shall I drive those cattle to Barber's, or..." He saw Webb and stopped with his mouth open.
"Bop, bop, 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 bop,"
cried the king, waving his arms.
"You hear what he says, Bud," said Webb Yeager. "We do what the king commands."
And that is all, except for one thing. When old man Quinn, owner of the Saco Ranch, went to look at his new English cattle, he asked his new foreman, "What's a Nopalito Ranch's mark?"
"X over Y," said Wilson.
"I thought so," said Quinn. "But look at that white animal there. She has another mark, a heart with a cross inside. Whose mark is that?"
That was the American short story, Hearts and Crosses. The writer O. Henry published it in 1907 as part of his Heart of the West series. I'm Katie Weaver. That's all the time we have for today. But Christopher Jones Cruz will be here tomorrow with the Sunday edition of Learning English Weekend.